Welcome to Shazam, the podcast that hopes to make itself obsolete. I'm your host, Kayla Drescher, and today, a magical woman talking to a magical woman about magic and women. Nailed it. And it begins in 3, 2, 1. Hey there, and welcome to what is still October 2020. Huzzah. Before we get started in this week's episode, we have our very first round of Patreon shoutouts. Oh, I'm so excited. This is so cool. So I want to give a giant shout out to our two new executive producers. That is Brandon Martinez and Amanda Eggle. Hey, friends. Thank you so much for being executive producers. That's really cool of you. And then our new producers are Sam Wheeler and Rob Belchunas. Thank you both so much for being producers on the podcast. Could not do this without you. If you are interested in becoming executive producers, getting a shout out, getting swag, all of that, definitely head over to our Patreon. A link is in the show notes. Bowie's show notes. Okay, continuing. This week, I don't really have too much to update you on. There's been a lot of Oreo cookies in my house and Harry Potter Hogwarts battle. And that's kind of it. It's been exciting. So why am I still talking? Let's just get to this episode. This week's episode is a fantastic interview with the amazing Connie Boyd. If you don't know who Connie is, from the early days of dance and circus to her debut and magic shows in Las Vegas, that's right, she debuted her magic career in Las Vegas. Wow. From touring internationally with award-winning magic to producing magic production shows, from mentoring to providing contracts for emerging talent, nothing has been impossible for Connie's journey. Very early on in Connie's magic career, she began working with Don Wayne, Joni Spina, and Shimada to create magic and illusion routines that were her own distinctive signature presentations. Connie's show, The Beauty of Magic, was an award-winning international success, and her magic was unique in its physicality and presentation. She has been called delicious entertainment and is credited as breaking the glass ceiling in magic and has been called the foremost woman in magic of our time. Pre-pandemic, Connie offered four different magic, illusion, and magic production shows, Illusionista, Chicks with Tricks, The Beauty of Magic, and Illusions, each starring a different woman in magic. With shows frozen in time due to COVID, Connie's newest project is Magical Women, which features weekly magical celebrity guest talks and sequels on her YouTube channel. The series includes magicians in all genres of magic, honestly talking and sharing their success, struggles, and challenges. Her goal is to create a visual source and document women in magic in 2020. Guest stars include, but are not limited to, Juliana Chen, Billy Kidd, Josephine Lee, Diana Zimmerman, Tina Leonard, Jen Kramer, Kristen Lambert, Kayla Drescher, ooh, that one sounds fun, and many, many more. In August, Connie collaborated with Paul Romani, the publisher of Vanish magazine, and Magical Women articles are now included in Vanish and published monthly. Yay! And be sure to check out this week's Just Saying. Check it out. Do it. Anyway, Connie's energy and passion for magic is clearly evident, as is her creativity to make the most of each and every opportunity, even in a pandemic, finding the beauty of magic that makes her a magical woman. So let's get to it. Please welcome Connie Boyd. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Kayla. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
Happy 2020. This is so cool because a couple weeks ago, we had a conversation with Magical Women, and now you're on Shazam. So this is really fun to kind of have like a cool crossover.
You turned the tables.
Yes. I'm so excited because now I get to ask you the questions and I don't have to look as good as I did before. So that's really nice.
Yeah, the beauty of not wearing makeup.
Isn't it great? Yeah, this is not a video format. I was impressed with how you were like, this is going to be a video format. I was like, that's great. I would never take that on. That's commitment. Well done, Connie.
Yeah. To be honest, I didn't want to be in front of the camera. I retired my wand in 2016 and I didn't want to be in front of the camera. And I tried to find other people to be interested in the project. And unfortunately, with the pandemic, everybody's sort of caught up in their own lives and nobody really wanted to commit to it because it's turned into be quite a work hog. And so the only way I could actually make it happen was to get in front of the camera. So I sucked it up and I did it. That's but awesome. I really didn't want to be in front of the camera. I like editing. I like being behind the scenes. I love being off stage. I don't miss it at all.
That's just so funny to come from someone who's had like a vast performing career.
Yeah.
To go, I was ready. I'm over it. Yeah. That's great. So speaking of your performing career, let's just start with the annoying standard question, which is what was the beginning of what became a career in magic?
Well, I trained with the National Ballet of Canada. I trained as a dancer and my dream was to be a ballerina. So I was very fortunate. I auditioned for the National Ballet of Canada and I was accepted to the school and I was on scholarship at the National Ballet of Canada and I developed tendonitis. I didn't know it at the time. I was just stupid. And I danced on injured ankles thinking that they would go away. So one injured ankle went to the second injured ankle, which went to my knees. And then I thought, well, maybe I should have this checked by the physiotherapist, at which point I could barely walk. So I had to do intensive physiotherapy. And while I was doing physiotherapy and watching all of the dancers in my class get better, which was pretty devastating, I saw an audition for a circus. And it was a one-ring European circus called Circus Tivoli. And I did the audition and miraculously got the job. And so they sent me to Florida and taught me two circus acts. And the two circus acts were Adagio hand balancing and perch pole. And I don't know if you know what perch pole is, but it's like a man balances a pole on the center of his head and you climb up and you press handstands and hang from your heels. And because I had strong legs and quite high arches, I could do some things just naturally because, you know, you're a dancer. And other things, upper body strength was quite challenging. So I had to really work on that. So I did that and literally ran away and joined the circus, much to my family's dismay. So I worked in the circus. After that, I was offered a contract in Mexico and I went to Mexico and started learning single trapeze and working with a juggler. And the juggler and I worked in circuses all over in Japan, in Hawaii, toured the United States and Canada and Mexico. And we were considered to be pretty strong entertainers in our two fields. And at the Astrodome in Houston, a piece of rigging broke. I used to go up as a butterfly and I flew up to my trapeze with a method called iron jaw, which means that you bite down in a mouthpiece so you're completely free. Yeah. And you fly up with these beautiful wings and I drop the wings and I grab my trapeze, kind of like a little Tinkerbell thing.
That sounds awful.
Oh, I loved it. You know, it
was really beautiful. Like the jaw thing?
Yeah, yeah. Like they call it jaws of death, but really it's more your neck and I guess a bit your jaw. So I was flying
up. You say it like it's fine. And I'm over here going, this apple's too hard. Yeah, I can't bite through it. I'm out. No. Like that's amazing.
No, but it's the back of your jaw. It's not your actual teeth. It's actually like, think of a bull terrier. You know, that kind of thing. So you literally, So I flew to my trapeze and I'd had a new mouthpiece made and it cracked. And so a piece of rigging broke and I fell to the floor and broke 7 bones in my feet. And so I was very fortunate because we were at the Astrodome and they had fabulous surgeons, orthopedic surgeons, because of the football teams that are from there. And so the doctor was the main surgeon and he put my feet back together and he was quite fascinated because the top of my arch, I broke the top of my arch on my right foot and it's almost impossible bone to break unless you fall to the floor on concrete with your toes pointed. and he had only seen it.
I love you still had your toes pointed.
I fell at the back of the swing, so just went boom. He had only seen it one other time in his entire career, and that was a construction worker had dropped, I think, concrete or something on top of his foot, but it's a very particularly difficult bone to break. Of course, that's the one I broke that was the most concerning. So he put it together with screws, and then they said, oh, you'll limp for the rest of your life. You know, you'll have a collapsed arch. And I was like, send me to physiotherapy. So I went to physiotherapy and within 9 months, I'd pretty well fixed the collapsed arch and I was working on stage with the juggler. and was performing trapeze, but not the things, like I couldn't do catches by my ankles or anything, but I could do other things. So learned a neck spin, learned alternative things to continue to complete contracts. But I can honestly say that after that point in time, because I did really crazy things on the trapeze, I did ankle drops, knees to ankles and knees to heels without gimmicks. So I did some really serious technical trapeze tricks. And I just didn't feel as confident after I'd fallen. And so I finished my contracts. And at that point in time, we had a contract in Splash at the Riviera Hotel. And I was training backstage, still doing trapeze. And they offered me a contract if I wanted it at Reno, because the man in Reno, the aerialist, had fallen. But they wanted me to work topless. And I have great respect for women in Las Vegas that are showgirls that work topless, but aesthetically, I don't have implants. And so aesthetically, going to the side, it's not pretty. You know, I couldn't see any benefit from it other than it, like if I was in a beautiful sheer suit that was supported, you know, that I would have had no problem with that. You know, transparent, not a problem, but topless, gravity just didn't make any sense to me. And if you also consider that I was a little bit fearful, and when you're fearful, you shouldn't be doing something in the air. So I said no, and I was just training in Las Vegas, and I was in Splash at the Riviera. And there was a magician puppeteer in the show named Barclay Shaw, and I watched his magic every night. He did the most beautiful levitation that to this day, I think it's my favorite levitation. Mm. And it was so close to the audience, and the girl that he levitated with, breathtakingly beautiful. It was exquisite piece of magic. So she appeared, and then he mesmerized her, and she floated off of a bench very close to the audience. And then they put her inside a plexiglass case, and she floated within the plexiglass case. And then she finished, and it was just beautiful. And I watched every night. And he saw me in the wings, and he's like, I see you watch magic. Do you like, you know, are you a magician? And I said, no, I just love this piece. I can't stop watching it. It's just beautiful. And he said, you know, you should be a magician. If you like magic that much, you should be a magician. And I had never considered being a magician. I knew nothing about magic other than I liked his levitation and his magic. And he was actually a puppeteer that had a love for magic. So he built me a three-way screen to produce a duck, and he talked to his manager, who in turn said if I had an act, they could book it, because at that point in time in Las Vegas, there were no other female magicians. And so that was the rocky road of my start of magic. And I had a very rough start. I invested of my own money, $30,000 in illusions, none of which worked. And it was an absolute catastrophe. And I had to learn very quickly, even though I had a manager and representation, that I was responsible for my magic. You know, now I was sitting with all this broken equipment. And it's funny because I did have somebody at the time that I hired to help me make these decisions, but the mistake wasn't made purposefully. But unfortunately, he recommended very bad prop builder. And that very bad prop builder, everything he sent was wrong. So I'll just give you an example. Blair Farrington, who is a beautiful director, producer, choreographer. He danced when he was a dancer with Anne Margaret. He's just an A++. And he choreographed my first act. And I was in awe of him because he was the best at the time. And we had it was like a trolley, and they stacked suitcases. And then I appeared out of these stacked suitcases in the sort of 40s sort of feel with steamer trunks. And he stood on the prop to demonstrate how I should open the doors to exit. And he fell into the base because the trap broke. That's the quality of equipment that I was provided for. It was just awful. You couldn't have a worse start. And so it was either sink or swim. And I had committed to it. And I said, okay, if I'm going to do this, I have to be responsible. So coming from my dance background and having some of the best teachers in the world at the ballet school that I went to, I knew that if I worked with the best, I had a good chance of success. So I said, who is David Copperfield's magic consultant? And they said, Don Wayne. And I said, how do I get a hold of Don Wayne? So I called Don Wayne and explained who I was and that I had this magic that I didn't know what to do with, and I was in big trouble. And he was coming to Las Vegas, so he said he'd stay an extra 2 days and he would work with me. And, you know, Don Wayne was not cheap, but he came out and he worked with me, and he gave me a 3-page list, and he was coming back in 2 weeks, and he wanted to see if the list was going to be done or not, and if I was serious. And I worked day and night and got the list done. And I mean, we're talking things like going to welders and having harnesses remade and welded. And, you know, it was very specific, very intense list. And I managed to have it all done in the 3 weeks because I had no other alternative. This was a lot of money. Like, this was my savings was gone. I was in a terrible state. Like I say, literally didn't have a clue what I was getting myself into. So I came back, and that was the beginning of a lifetime relationship with Don Wayne and working with him. And anything I know about magic, the psychology of magic, how to create magic, how to create my own illusion, that all comes from him. And he was, I guess you would call him my mentor. He was amazing. And my other mentor in magic was Joni Spina. So I had two of the best mentors in the business. So going back to your question, my first show was at the Riviera Hotel at their Christmas show. And I did that production, the act that Blair Farrington worked with me at and choreographed. And I must say to non-dancers, magicians that are listening, coming from a ballet background, I was classically trained. So the style that you need for magic is absolutely not ballet. You don't want to look like a bunhead up there. You want to be sultry and sit on your hip and have a style. And it's more of a pop jazz kind of attitude that you need to have. And so it was, although I had a theater background and dance was beneficial, I had to retrain myself of how I needed to work and move as a magician and not to look like a dancer and also not to look like a ballerina, but to actually look like I was just in control of my props. And again, Joni was instrumental in helping me with that. But from the beginning, that was a conscious effort to, I call it de-dance, you know, anti-dance, to try to take the dancer out of me and to try to become a skilled magician. That was really important, especially when you're working in shows where you have 50 dancers, like the Folies Bergère or Bally's. There were, you know, dancers, and why would I compete with the dancers? I needed to stand on my own two feet and be different than anybody before me or after me. So
I think it's really amazing that, because most people are like, I got a magic kit, or I started doing magic at my dad's restaurant or whatever it is. And you're like, I got a contract at the Riviera, which is just like the opposite situation. Yeah. You started at the top of the ladder, which is really amazing.
But it was also terrifying because I never felt worthy. And the more I learned about the art form of magic, the more I realized like what a bumbling fool I was to get into it. And I wanted to do it proud. So I think in the long run, I worked harder and probably made an extra effort because I didn't feel like I merited some of the opportunities that I had been given so freely at the beginning.
Yeah, I think that's really important, is that a lot of times in situations like that, we have imposter syndrome. It's like, oh, I'm not supposed to be here. And there are better people. And I get that from talking to you last time. I get that all the time still. And so I think it's awesome. You know, you work really, really hard to make sure there's no question like you belong here. Also to point out that you had Joni Spina, Shimada, Don Wayne, so many people. And like most people have a mentor named Steve who's good at the paddle. And like there's nothing against Steve. He's great. He's really perfected the paddle and good for them. And it's like, oh no, hi, my name's Connie. My first show was in Vegas. It's so cool to see the difference in trajectory between, I mean, like for me, comparatively between the two of us, is my start was so small, seemingly big, but still small. And yet I love the idea of just going, if you get 3 pages from Don Wayne, you do them. If you get told you're opening for Jeff McBride when you're 12 years old, you make it the best 5 minutes of your life. And like, you just do it. And I love the idea that no matter which version of the story you come from, if you just work hard, boom.
Yeah, I tell the girls that I work with, if the door opens, you jeté through it. A jeté is a giant split leap. And you need to be ready because if it opens, you go. You know, so you have to be ready for those opportunities when they happen. Yeah. And you have to be humble. I mean, if somebody is kind enough to give you advice and suggestions, and you know, you may or may not agree with them, but they've taken the time out of their day to give those suggestions to you. So you have to give value to people. And I, again, I was extremely fortunate, you know. And Joni was Joni and Don were my friends. You know, you don't sure. you don't have people like that in your life for that many years. And
yeah,
I was lucky enough to call them my friends. So.
That's great. So you're in Vegas. You do Vegas. You yeah. kill Vegas. When did the cruise ships come into play? Was there things in between Vegas? I yeah. mean, obviously, you toured Europe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hated cruise ships. I'm not a drinker, so I'm not a partier. You can't see me on a podcast, but I am milk white. So the beach and I don't really connect. So I found them very boring when I started cruise ships. But what I determined was one of the keys to being an illusionist. And it's interesting, when I spoke to Josephine Lee a couple weeks ago, we talked about keeping assistants and how difficult it is. If your boyfriend or your husband or your partner is not in your show, you have to keep staff, you have to keep assistants, you know, and they're part of your magic team. And you're training all the time, which I've gotten very good at. And at that point in time in my career, I did everything I possibly could to keep my team with me, because I had excellent men working with me at the time. And so let's say we were in Vegas, and at that point in time, they stopped giving long contracts. So I think we were doing maybe 4 months on, 2 months off or something. I forget the scheduling, but in those 2 months, we might go to Atlantic City. We might go to Tahoe if we had a booking. But if we didn't have a booking, we'd go on a cruise ship out of the Caribbean. And it was less money, but the boys worked one time a week and they were having like a vacation for pay. And at that point in time, you know, cruising has changed a lot. But at that point in time, we were given passenger cabins. We had complete passenger status. It was pretty nice. And we could rehearse in the theater for free. And there's the bonus. So I would take on everything new we were working on, and we would rehearse at night. So the boys would go out and do the beach, and, you know, they did what they had to do and enjoyed doing. But we had free rehearsal studio space. And as an illusionist, free rehearsal studio space is key, yeah. because I used to have to pay, I think at that time, the going rate was like $30 an hour for a studio to rehearse in Vegas. So it was expensive rehearsing, but I could go off to the cruise ships and technicians would help you. Like, they move props and stuff, and you'd buy them beer and they were happy, you know? So it was like a whole different world, but it was a really good world for us, because I debuted new material. Because in Vegas, you couldn't debut new material because there were 1,000 magicians behind my back that wanted, there were limited number of jobs, and it yeah. was a good job. So, you know, you can't risk. You can maybe put something small in or something you're sure of, but if you've already established on the ship that it's going to be a great piece of magic, then you'll do that. Like, I ventured off into a little bit of comedy, and I ventured off into different things that I wanted to pursue. But when you're working, you know, 12 shows a week that they booked you for, it has to be pretty strong and pretty good. So that's how I ended up in cruise ships. And yeah, in Europe, again, we were fortunate. I worked in Germany and France and Italy, and a lot in Asia in the early 90s, in Osaka and in Tokyo. And, you know, because my look was exotic. And again, I can't stress enough to magicians to have routines that are specific to you and what your skill set is, no matter what your skill set is, whether you're funny or you have a specific character or close up, whatever. But whatever your genre of magic is, have routines that are specific to you. So people talk about what you did magically, not what your magic did. So you don't want them talking about a specific trick more than you want to talk about that fabulous magician that did such and such.
When then did you start saying, I have this great show, but I don't really want to do it anymore, so I'm going to have another woman do it? How did that come about?
Well, I started with a 12-minute act and then slowly grew it to 20 minutes, then 25. And then we had an opening act position, which was 30, 35 minutes. And we had corporate act show, you know, so we slowly grew it until eventually I had my 90-minute magic show. And then when I went to Europe, I divided it in two. And because I get bored, I did two different shows on two different ships, because why wouldn't you? And so I had been working for a cruise company for a while, and they were looking for a magic consultant for a cruise line that they were launching called the Magica. And they wanted to put together a magic production with no magician. They wanted it to be magic that the dancers and the singers could do. They bless these dancers and singers. So they had to have a complete other skill set. And I put together a proposal, and I ended up getting the job. And then I had to order the magic and create the magic. Some of it I made, and some of it Bill Smith made several pieces. At that point in time, still with Shall I Imagine, had a couple pieces. So Norm Nielsen, may he rest his soul, he gave us Houdini posters. And he gave us the rights to use his Houdini poster artwork. And so they did an entire Houdini set of his posters in the back. Every time I see that, I think of him and how gracious he was and how kind. We lost another legend. Yeah. Good man. Very talented magician. So I ended up doing that and had quite a big success with that. It was a big challenge. For example, we did a levitation from Splash's creative, and it was in a voodoo scene. And so it had to all look like a jungle. And the poor singer, he sang Black Magic Woman, and then he had to levitate the virgin. So this poor guy who is just saying and has a giant headdress on has to stand on the levitation and nowhere to stand. So I made special heel guards so that they couldn't possibly stand in the wrong place and, you know, have the thing go up their leg. And I tried to make the magic dancer proof so that they could execute this magic in a credible manner and not be embarrassing. Yeah, we had Harry Potter balls and all kinds of crazy things happening in this show. Bill Smith did the beautiful snake basket. One snake went in and two snakes came out. And that was in the Arabian Nights scene. And so the producers knew specifically what they wanted. Like, they had their format of their show. I didn't produce the show. It wasn't my concept. But they had their format. And it was almost like a fantasy, like a pantomime, like an English pantomime. So big, elaborate costumes and lots of fun things to do magically. And that show is still running almost 15 or more years later. It's still running, the show. Yeah. It's proven to be successful and timeless, like a fairy tale. But doing that show, it made the entertainment director of the cruise company, it inspired him. And he liked the idea of a magic production. So he was on a limited budget and he asked another production company that had a different ship if they would be willing to work with me and we would produce a show together that was a magic production, but with me as the star. Yeah. So I was I'm very lucky, very fortunate, because the producers of the show are a South African production company called Afro Arimba. And one of the producers was actually the entertainment director of Sun City for a point in time. So they are extremely knowledgeable. And one of their partners, they were so ahead of their time for audiovisual. Even things I was seeing in Vegas, they were ahead of their time, because their partner was a director for National Geographic. So they had all of this phenomenal audio video on, like, fans with sculptures and stuff. I'd never seen anything like this in my life. Like, it was just beautiful work, their work. And they worked with me and basically taught me how to produce a show. So I learned from the beginning, middle, and end how to produce a magic show. They cast their dancers. I learned how to work with the dancers, how to teach magic to counts. I learned that on the consulting job. The one before, I learned how to teach magic to counts to dancers. If you teach it like choreography, they don't know it's hard. They do it like movement.
Ah, that's so really smart.
I went to a festival, and when they found out what we were doing and we were teaching every 6 months, and they're like, how are you doing that? And I went, we teach it like choreography. They don't know it's hard. And it worked. So we produced this show, and the show was a huge success. And it was so much fun because I had 9 or 10 dancers behind me. And, you know, usually I had my assistants, like my team. We're a magic team. It's a magic show. But this was a magic production show. Like, this had great fun and value. And then I got inspired and I created a new finale that was custom to that theater. And it was a black art, Things That Go Bump in the Night. And we produced the whole cast in Las Vegas feathers. You know, we just got crazier and crazier. So I was in that show for, I think, 2.5-3 years. And then the ship was repositioning to Asia. So the agent said to me, we want the show. Is it possible to, you know, somebody else do the show? And I said, well, I think if I modify the show, I can make it to a point that I can cast it. So I said, if you let me modify it. And they said, yeah, no, you just, you know, make it good. Make it good. So we changed some things in the show because I was doing guitar suspension and I was doing a straitjacket escape over a bed of nails. And so we changed those two variations. We ended up doing a metamorphosis with a straitjacket, which is a really good combination that you don't see very often. So there were all kinds of fun things. So we kept the bass and more or less the music the same, but I just adjusted the show and started casting the show. And that's the long-winded story of how I ended up casting that first show.
That's amazing. So Rob Belchunas, who is a massive friend of mine and friend of the pod, and also asks a question in every single episode so far anyway, has said, what are some of the important things to consider when you design a show that quote unquote anyone can do? Right. What's the level of skill that you're requiring? And do they have the ability to showcase their own personality? And how do you balance all of this in a successful show like this?
Wow, that's a lot of questions. Okay, so when I'm creating a magic production show from zero, I usually always use at least 3 or 4 numbers that I've performed already.
Great.
That is my secret, because I know I have those numbers that are going to be solid. And then I embellish maybe with an opening and a finale and something fun in the middle that I want to play with, because I like to play. One of the reasons I stayed in show business so long is that they let me play for the last 15 years. And it was just so much fun, and it stimulated me creatively. And they never said I couldn't do anything. It's only recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, that things have changed dramatically globally. But when I started, the world was my oyster. If I had an idea, I did it. And nobody said no. You know, they were just happy with anything I came up with. Basically, it was really fun. So going back to his question, I think key is to have a good portion of your show that you know is solid, proven, and has a track record, because you don't want to start an entire show from zero. I wouldn't personally want to do that. That doesn't mean that I may not modify costumes or a piece of music, but the essence of the magic that I know to be true and will work, I always try to have that in the show, because it's my crutch. It's my ace up my sleeve. So I think that's important.
When you're booking the women to do these production shows, what are you looking for? What's their level of dance skill, magic skill? What's the level of skill you're looking for when you are looking for that talent?
Well, I kind of shot myself in the foot, because...
Don't we all?
Yeah. Well, they had booked me and I had done the first magic production show. So that was what they were looking for. So they're looking for somebody that is physically strong, has an attractive physique, has a mysterious sort of vivacious, charismatic personality, and that has a good skill set of magic. And that is very difficult to find. And I learned that lesson the hard way. And this is no reflection on magicians, but I learned, in order to do the shows that were booked, and these are the shows that the company booked, it was easier for me to teach a dancer that I recognize has a specific skill set. I can usually flag them. Almost all of the girls that are working for me now, with the exception of one, they were performing in my magic shows. And I saw something in them in the magic show and went, okay, I'm going to watch her for a year and see. And it's how they handle crisis, how they look on stage, how they manage other people, all of those things. They're on a cruise ship. It's very important to get along with other people. If you have a temperamental person on land, and this also applied to my assistants, because I had temperamental assistants at certain points in time, on land, it's not an issue because they go home. But when you're on tour or you're on a enclosed place, which would be like a cruise ship, they have to get along with other people. And so that's another thing that you must take into consideration. You know, their people skills, it's really important to be diplomatic and have good people skills and to be aware of different cultures, because people say things and they may be horribly insulting. But if you do the translation from their language, it isn't. It's just that they're so, you know, you kind of look at them and blink and then go, okay, I think I know what you meant, you know. And I work with multicultural dancers, multicultural technicians, multicultural management. So it comes at you from all different fields.
Do the performers, the dancers that are being booked in these shows, do they get a chance to bring in some of their own personality as well?
Absolutely. Awesome. Yeah, I hate cookie cutter. If we did cookie cutter, it would be so flat. First of all, when you work with somebody, you know, you kind of get a feel what their personality is, their physique, their costuming, because what you wear is a costume. That makes you feel a specific way. So you try to make them feel, if it's a number that should be graceful and beautiful, you try to make them feel graceful and beautiful and accent every asset they have, because we are illusionists. And so we create the illusion if we don't have it. And if you do have it, we enhance it. So yeah, it's really important. Now the work is the work. Like, I'm not going to change an illusion, but I can change staging, choreography, and costuming to reflect that person's ability. So we've had some success with non-dancers doing magic, so you can adapt. But where I've encountered the most problems is the physicality of the work, because you need great stamina. I didn't realize this, but to do my shows, you have to be really fit. Like, it's 45, 50 minutes nonstop, and you can't like collapse in the middle, you know, so you have to be physically pretty strong and you have to be disciplined. And I find in general, a lot of magicians that do solo work aren't aware of lighting specials and musicality. So they don't understand that on a specific time in the choreography and the staging of your magic, the dancers are going to run behind you and you're going to be on this axe and you're going to hold the sword in this way. And there's a bunch of things that can happen. Dancers might knock you over. And if you aren't on your axe, nobody's going to see you because you're out of your lighting special. And if you're not holding the sword in the right way, you could injure somebody, including yourself. So those disciplines, which anybody that's had a theater background, it's, to me, it's 101. It isn't for a lot of magicians, unless they've got a theater or an acting background, and then they understand that. But I find, and I have found, unfortunately, to be true, that's a skill set that a lot of people need to work on. And I think if you were a magician that was booked into the illusionist, because they are very specific, they have beautiful lighting, they have, you know, LED behind you, they have, and you know yourself from being on tour with a big production, that there are things that when you're doing your own show and it's more organic, sort of grassroots kind of performance, you don't have to be that disciplined. You can be a little bit more relaxed. But when you're in a professional environment like that, it's much more disciplined and difficult. So to answer your friend's question, that's a really important factor to be aware of. All of those things.
Yeah. And so are those kind of the unfortunate, because you said there were some unfortunate experiences by hiring a magician. And obviously I'm not asking you for like names or drama, but I'm just curious in terms of magicians who might be interested in doing cruise ships or illusion shows in general, what are some other things that you saw hiring magicians to do the show? Was it mainly issues with lighting and choreography, or were you seeing other things as well? Like, what made you go, I'm going to hire dancers instead of magicians? What was that thing?
For me, it was the physicality, the stamina, and the aesthetic look that the company was looking for.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, because they want somebody that has a specific look. Mm. And you can adapt to a certain point. And with that look, it's the grace and the elegance and the, I don't want to say sensuality, but just that presence on stage that they were expecting. And when you're in a crunch time and you're trying to teach somebody and install them into the show, you can't teach them presence and grace and those things that, again, I'm very fortunate because I come from a dance background. So even though I say anti-dance, just being able to move gracefully and to handle the props in a mysterious way with style. And I already knew how to extend my leg and I knew how to look over my shoulder and engage the audience. Those are performance tips. And some of the great magicians, male and female, have those beautiful moments in their show, but it's not easy at all to teach if you're in a crunch and you're trying to teach, you know, the illusions and the technique. I always train the magicians when I have a cast that know the show. I would never put a cast change and a magician change at the same time. That would be suicide. Even with somebody that knows the show, it's just very difficult. I also find that dancers pick up very quick. It's muscle memory. You know, they're quick. And there's a time element also on board that unfortunately we only are allowed to cross train for a short period of time. And and I send videos in advance. I send everything in advance. I send the music in advance. When I send it to a dancer, when they come on board, they know the counts. They know the show before and they have to learn their magic, but they know, and it's hard for them. Like, it's not easy by any means, but I've had, under the conditions that I'm working with, the contracts I've been given for this specific cruise company, that's the success that I've had. If I had a different environment, for example, American Cruise Lines, at this point in time, they really are not looking for big illusion shows. But if you do perform illusions on American Cruise Lines, you want something self-contained with an assistant. And so you would rehearse all of that on land and you would go on land with your show and you would pace your show. Again, I think this might pertain more to your friend than the other question, because there's very few people right now producing magic production shows.
Right.
It's very difficult to get that opportunity and to keep it. just because it's such a specific little niche market. And I don't mean just with women, of course, with men, male magicians as well. But I think the chances of doing a magic show on a cruise ship pertains to the same thing. You want to pace your show so there's a beginning, middle, and end. You want to have comedic elements. You need audience participation because you want to do things in the audience to make them realize it's not a television show. It's a live show and they need to engage. They need to applaud.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Normally, I don't like to ask this question because I like quantifying and qualifying the women on Shazam as badass magicians or badass whatever they are. You've kind of touched upon it along the way, but what are the big positives? And then I'll use the word negatives, but like maybe something that seemed negative in the moment that empowered you to do something greater. What are the main positives and negatives that you've seen in your career from being specifically a woman in the industry?
One of the things from this Magical Woman series is your generation hasn't encountered what my generation did.
It's much
more accepting. And I know that from my niece as well. And just we've gained so much ground. And I think that's wonderful. And I consistently hear from the magicians that I got the job maybe because I was a girl, but I was also very good. And I like that. And I think that's wonderful. So yeah, it was a little bit of a good old boys mentality when I started. But I think life is choices and it's how you look at things. And I could have chosen to be bitter, to take it personally and to be offended. Or I could have said, and this is the way I approach everything, I'm going to do this and you're not going to stop me. And I can do it with you, I can do it without you, but I am going to do this and I'm going to do it well and I'm going to do it to the best of my abilities. And I try to treat everybody as I'd like to be treated. And I across the board do that. That's my mantra in life and I believe in it. And honey works better than vinegar. So kill them with kindness and be focused and you will succeed. And sometimes people confuse kindness with stupidity and they are stupid for thinking that because it's very important. Kindness gets you very far and it's worked for me. But, you know, there's been some horror stories along the way and I have got work because I'm a female and I've lost work. We were at the point of signing the contract for the Rockettes and I lost it because I was a female. They negotiated my name on the marquee and I cried and I don't cry easy. It's very rare to see me ever cry. I wanted to be in the Rockettes show. Yeah. And so that one really hurt. That was a point of contention, but I've gotten over it now.
You don't have to get over it. I'm not over it for you.
Yeah. So I think that there's pluses and minuses along the way. I think it's, again, how you see the world. And I try to see things positively. I try to be proactive. I try to always look on the bright side of life because if anything, travel has shown me that there are people living in conditions much worse than we could even ever imagine. And I'm just so grateful for everything I have and that I thought was normal that I now know is not normal. And we're very lucky to be in a profession that we enjoy and that stimulates us and that we've managed to make a living at. So whether you're a woman or a man, I think it's just your grit, your determination. But I am very pleased to say that your generation here is, you're not encountering the obstacles that we've encountered in the past. But they're always, I think it's just who you know. And yeah, I think anybody in any workplace can find a point of contention if you look for it.
Yeah.
Not to diminish. I know there have been horror stories. So I hope I haven't offended any women that had horror stories, but that's just my opinion on the matter.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you I personally have had horror stories. And one of the things that kind of always frustrated me was hearing from older female friends within the magic industry saying, well, it's not nearly as tough as it used to be. And it's like, well, then what about my experience? Because I didn't have that experience. So my experience is tough because it's mine. But also, yes, my experience is not nearly as tough as if I lived in a country where I wasn't given any rights because of how I was born. I'm also white, so I know I have privilege. Like there's a lot of things that I completely understand and
agree.
I'm with it that it's not the worst. It's just my experience. But hearing the horror stories from people who are older than me is like, oh, okay, yeah, I totally get that. I'm very happy I didn't experience some of that, but also I've experienced some crap and some great. Exactly. And you're exactly right. It's like, it all just depends on, you know, for me, it I feel like I did both of the be bitter and also grow and work harder. And that's okay. Like, I think I've earned both of those reactions. Whereas a lot of my friends quit. They would just quit magic. We had Jen Adams on, who just literally quit magic.
I listened to that podcast. That was a fascinating podcast.
Yeah. She's amazing.
Yeah. And she had a terrible experience in Vegas.
Yeah. And amongst like Vegas plus celebracadabra. And she was just like, I'm out. I'm done. I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And I totally get that. You know, we all have our breaking point. But it's also nice that when you have a community around you,
yes,
which is the point of Shazam, the point of Magical Women, the point of everything, is like you have a community around you that says, no, it's cool. This was bad, but let's let it be bad and let it happen, but not let it deter you from what you actually love doing. And having that community is so valuable.
Agreed. As you're saying that, I'd forgotten one of my first contracts was in Malaysia at Genting Highlands in Kuala Lumpur. And I had two assistants that traveled with me, and the technicians, the stage manager and management wouldn't talk to me. They would only talk to them. And they kept saying, ask Connie, we don't know. So we went round and round for quite a while until they realized that they really didn't know. And that the only way they were going to get things done was they were going to have to talk to me. And I understood that I was in a very strange place and that they had never seen a female in this place before. We're talking, this is a long time ago. This is the late 80s. So by the time I finished the contract, they would come right up to me and talk to me, and they brought their wives to the show, and they got comfortable with me, and I was respectful to them, because it wasn't that they were being disrespectful to me. It's that they didn't know what to do with me. I was an alien. You know, I didn't look like them, and I was a woman on top of it. You know?
Right.
It's terrible.
This cannot compute. Like, this does not make sense.
So it was kind of cool. And so when I do things like that, it makes you feel good, because when we left, they were sorry to see us go. We'd made friends. Show business is a beautiful thing. You know, you get to see all different cultures and people from all walks of life, and you get to embrace that. And what you learn from travel, you can't learn that in university.
No, I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you. Let's talk about Magical Women.
Okay.
Go.
So once everybody was home and everybody was sorted, and we were informed that all our cruise contracts were canceled and that we couldn't go back and pack up the shows. So we are literally frozen in time. I would say probably till 2021, but at least till the end of the year, I would imagine. If it changes, I'll adapt, but you know, we'll see. So I was sitting at home and I was thinking, what can I do? And Franz Ferrari was in a very similar situation with his show in China. I don't know if you're familiar, but he had a show in China. It was opening night and they closed opening night. So we were commiserating and he was doing his quarantine talk. So we did a quarantine talk together and we discussed producing shows and, you know, all of the good, bad and ugly with that. And he then said at the end of the show, he said, you know, Connie, you're pretty good at this. You know, you're pretty tight. And I said, well, I've done a little bit of publicity in my time, you know, and he's like, no, but you should think about doing a talk yourself. And I went, I don't want to do a talk. I don't want to be in front of the camera. And so we left it at that. And I came back and I started thinking about things that I could do. And I realized that there wasn't a place, a visual place, where women in magic were documented. And I thought, well, what if I did a series on women in magic that pertain to where we are in 2020? Because we have a whole group of women that are aging that I'd like to document them before something happens to them. And they had so much success in their time, but the video isn't available like now. They're not on YouTube. And yet what they did and what they achieved is remarkable. So I thought, well, that would be really cool. And then I thought, well, there are so many people now that are in lockdown in so many different genres of magic, more than I've ever seen in my entire lifetime. Wouldn't it be cool to pick, you know, maybe 10 female magicians and interview them and put a series together? So I reached out to Ekaterina, who's in Montreal and has a YouTube channel. And I knew her because when I was casting, I knew of her from doing the casting before. So I knew of her, and I had seen Carissa Hendricks, your Carissa, in February.
kidding, absolutely kidding.
I saw Carissa in February. I was visiting my family in Toronto, and I happened to just buy tickets to see a show because I wanted to support the local magic community, and Carissa was there. I'd never met her. I wasn't familiar with her work, and I fell in love with her work in Lucy Darling. So that was just a great find for me earlier this year. So I reached out to her too and said, you know, this is what I'm thinking to do. So both of them were really instrumental in helping me to sort of weed through all of this chaos that was in my mind. And again, that's how I work. I just throw everything against the wall and then it trickles down. And then I kind of weed through what I think can happen and what I like. And then I end up with something that maybe is tangible. And I do that with illusions. I do it with costuming. I do it with everything. It's just the way I work. So I talked to them and I weeded through and I said, okay, I'm going to create a show. The working title was Wonder Woman. I was so excited about my Wonder Woman theme, you know, and so many people shot it down. But in my head, that's everybody that was in magic and had survived. They were all Wonder Women. We all needed capes and we were made from Kevlar. And so that was what I was thinking about the whole thing. And we all should have invisible planes. So
thank you. Get places so much faster.
Yeah, exactly. Just think what we could escape from. So life would be beautiful. So I reached out to Laura Soler, that is my media manager that I have, and she's quite good at branding and all social media platforms. She's very good with. So we started brainstorming. Now she's in Milan and I'm not in Milan, but so it's like a 6-hour time change. But we're talking back and forth and we're trying different names. And I have, you know, I've been writing names down and because apparently Wonder Woman was going to be an issue. So I don't know why. Apparently no. It's trademarked.
Whatever.
So we came up with Magical Women and that ended up being our working title. And then I was driving one day and I realized that the M and the W, as you do, does that happen to you, Caleb, when you're
all
driving?
All the time.
Yeah. These ideas just come. I don't know if it uses some part of your brain when you're driving or you're relaxing. I don't know. But anyway, the M and the W, I all of a sudden realized they could be lips. And that would be the Magical Women. And then I knew I had the right title for the show because I had lips. So then I knew I was right. And then I called her and she couldn't quite understand. So I had to draw it on a piece of paper and then she got it. And then we were off. And so then we had a brand and a logo. And then I needed to put together a show. So we did a teaser and I reached out to you. I reached out to at least a dozen magicians at that time. And everybody was really enthusiastic and there were only two people not available and it was because they had other commitments, not because they weren't interested in the project. But everybody else was excited and understood the importance of it because now anywhere in the world, if people look up Magical Women, they're going to have a source for magicians that are working in 2020. But they're also going to be able to listen to Abigail McBride and Diana Zimmerman and Tina Leonard and to glean these fabulous nuggets and knowledge from these individuals that have just had phenomenal careers. It's pretty exciting. And I've learned so much from each of the guests because they're very forthcoming and very honest. So we've had all kinds of really fun stories. Like Juliana Chan revealed that her worst magic mistake is she forgot her underwear. And if you listen to her story and how it happened, it's so beautiful because, you know, she had all of these loads and all of this stuff and she got distracted. And if you understand her costuming, like when she told the story, it was funny. But when I actually was doing the video editing and I saw that her costume's cut all the way up to her hip, I realized how provocative this could have been. So it was just like, and she's so, you know, she's just, you think Juliana Chen, she's perfect. But it was just this beautiful story that was so honest and refreshing. And it was just great. And we all have had terrible nightmares happen to us on stage. And people have shared those and some of the things that they've overcome. And it's a hodgepodge. It's, you know, we're all human and we all have things within our stories that are of interest, I think, and provide insight of overcoming hurdles, overcoming struggles, understanding the successes and why they're successes. Because sometimes the success to the magician isn't the success to the real world, but it's your success that you've achieved. And that's really important. And it's important to share those stories so people don't feel so alone. Like you said, when you're on your own out on the road, it's a tough grind. When you're the only magician on an entire ship and you're trying to explain to somebody something that's important magically, they don't care. They think you're being a diva. They don't understand that this is non-negotiable. This is, you know, you have to have this. And they don't see the difference between that and something that's just silly. You know, yeah. So it's really important to have that community. I think this is the same for you, Kayla, that most of our viewers are men. And yeah. I was surprised by that. I didn't realize that. there's an analytic that you can look at, and it was primarily men. And I went, well, of course, that does make sense because sure. most magicians are men and cool. They're watching it and they're interested and I'm engaged and I'm really pleased. But I thought maybe 50-50 or even, you know, 60-40 women. But no. So yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's so cool. Do you have a plan for, because Magical Women, obviously you can see all the ones you've put out so far. Do you have a plan for the future? Like what's going to happen with Magical Women moving forward?
In my dream world, it would go on indefinitely.
Great.
Because I'd love to document as much as I could just for the history of magic, just so we have a place where we can go. There are books, like I have some books here, but I literally like turn down the pages and put clips where a woman's mentioned because you have to read lots of chapters before you find some little tip right. about how the women became. And in the past, most of the women that did become magicians because something happened to their husbands. You know, that seemed yes. to be, I mean, Adelaide Herman, who was a phenomenal magician, but it was because something happened to her husband. Barclay Shaw, who suggested I'd become a magician, actually, his first magician he ever saw was a female magician called Cleopatra. And she was a magician because her husband, and this is a horrible story, but true, her husband was decapitated from the buzzsaw when they were in an accident. Oh, you couldn't make this stuff up.
Goodness.
It's okay. In the history of magic because I had read it. When I read it, I went, oh, that's Barclay's Cleopatra, you know, because nobody knew who she was. And he would go on and on about her that she had this giant show and it was just a huge extravaganza. And so he had no qualms with a woman being a magician. Like to him, it was just natural because the first magician he saw was a woman. So it was kind of neat. In the future, if I had the time in the mind, I'd like to break it down a little bit more. First, I have this series and then I'll probably do a secondary series just to try to catch as many North Americans and probably British magicians as I can. Mm-hmm. And then I'd like to break it down into segments more and maybe do a series of maybe 10 interviews with people that are knowledgeable in the history of magic. And then maybe do a series on partners in magic because you've got yeah. Ginger, who is a magician in her own right. You've got Misty Knight. You've got Charlotte Pendragon. You've got people that were partners, and yet they're magicians. So it would be really interesting to have a series focusing on that. I would love to do that. And then
awesome.
I'd like to focus on Asia because there are dozens of Asian female magicians, one better than the next. And it would be, with Juliana Chan's help, it would be really phenomenal to be able to find out more about that because we really don't know. That's an area in the Western world. We know maybe a few. And of course, I know of Princess Tenko, the famous Japanese magician, and was within my age range. So I knew of her because we were performing at the same time. But magicians now in Asia, we don't really know very much about them, female magicians in Asia. And then there's South America and there's Europe. The list just keeps growing and going. And so it could be a labor of love. And, you know, then we should really have a website. And then we should, but we'll have to see what happens, you know, with our world and our pandemic and how much time and energy I can continue to focus on this. But while I have this time, I'm trying very hard to document and do as much as I can. I feel a great pressure to do it, and I don't know why, but I do. So,
yeah, similar. I also felt a great pressure to start this podcast. So I get you on that. Is you're like, yeah, this hasn't been done, and I think I'm the one to do it. Boom, that, and here we are.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And so what you've done is remarkable. You know, it's just really good. Yeah, like I say, I haven't listened to as much as I'd like, but what I have listened to is just really insightful and honest. And
thank you.
Yeah, really good.
Thanks. Yeah. And same as like, I've watched a good handful of Magical Women. And I think what's great is that we have sister projects that focus on different things and have different goals, but with the same overall goal. Because when Shazam started, which is now almost 3 years ago, is there was nothing else. And then all of a sudden women were on the cover of Vanish magazine, which hadn't happened before. Which is not a Shazam thing. It's just like from this date to now, this happened. And then Magical Women, and then just more and more stuff. And it's like, this is awesome. This is great. So stuff is progressing. And of course, what happens is you take one step forward, two steps back. And so there's always sort of the idea that these projects will always be necessary because there will always be people who say, that's stupid, that's not necessary, which I've encountered a lot with Shazam. But that's okay because I don't care. I'm over it. Like, this is necessary. We're talking about great things. And those who don't want to listen are just going to fall behind the time.
Well, it's interesting because I had a little pushback about calling it magical women because they said you should just be magicians. It shouldn't be that you're a woman. And I am a woman. And so there are things with my physique that I have to adapt for my magic. Like, for example, no male magician could do the flying that I did with the system I did because they could not physically do it.
Wouldn't feel
and, good. No, they'd do it once. That would be the end.
But
of course any female magician out there knows the challenges we have with pockets, but you overcame that beautifully on Penn and Teller with a handbag.
Thank you.
It was a beautiful
piece. That was all Johnny Thompson.
And again, somebody that was a legend and extremely experienced and innovative and creative and embraced all magicians, just wanted magic to be excellent. He was, great. So we've overcome those things, but I think we need to address them because I'm just trying to think there could be also issues for male magicians maybe that are shorter than tall statuettes. How do they overcome with their tuxedos? You know, if you have a barrel body as opposed to a chiseled body, it's just magic in general, but there are things like sewing your tights, you know, and you know, how do you mend fishnets? And if you're using a thumb tip, how do you make it look natural? Yeah. So as a woman, because, you know, there's options out there that we can share. And I think both series, listening to these stories of these women, it makes you aware that you're not alone. You're not the first one that's encountered this problem. And maybe rather than go through the 70,000 options, maybe there was something, if you'd listened to your podcast, you'd had it in, you know, 2 minutes, you're like, oh, that's what I should have done. I didn't think of that, you know? So.
Yeah. Or at least just like the idea that it feels really negative and it feels like maybe I can't do magic if I don't have the same tools that everybody else has. And so to just know, even if I don't have the answer or if the answer hasn't been spoken about yet, then at least you know that there's a ton of people you could go to ask questions, to actually get the answer that you need, because there's a community of supportive magicians, some of whom are women, some of whom are guys, and you just have a massive group of people who are willing to help because we all understand that there's different levels of the struggle. And that's what was missing to me before the podcast is that there wasn't a community of people that knowingly you could go to. Again, like you, I just happen to be lucky and have a lot of people I could ask questions to who would then know the resources, but not everybody has that. And that's what hopefully we can provide with our projects.
Right. And one of the things that, because I came from dance, I feel much more solid in dance because I've strong dance background, and when they're auditioning or casting, I can clock immediately who's cheating, what their technique is. It's just I can't help it, and it helps for magic too because I can see why it's not working, because your whole life you've been working with bodies, so you understand movement and proportions, and so you can help people because you understand that if you're talking about illusions, for example, this person can't physically do it that way because they can't get on the prop that way, so we're going to have to adapt for this person to do it this way. And I think it's the same for close-up or for anything, you know, if you've got small hands, if you've got huge windows, you know, if you're doing stage magic and you're a sweater and you're doing cards, it's how do you overcome all of these huge challenges? And it's possible if you have people that you can have a little bit of feedback with. But you coming from Tannins and all of that, that's the magical woman this week is 15 years old and she's from New York and she's actually a magic creator. And she's a magician, and her name is Amanda Nepo. And
Amanda, great!
Yeah, I love her.
She's awesome,
and she's so inspiring, and upbeat, and articulate, and clever. Like you see what she's just coming up with continuously, and she's the future. If the future is like that, I'm very optimistic about what the future holds. But she comes from Tannins and has had a wonderful experience and nothing but nurturing, you know, from that whole community. So I think we're on the right track. I think there's always going to be good and bad people. We all have to survive the good and bad, and not everybody's going to agree with you or I, and we may not agree all the time, but that's okay. You know, people can have opinions, you know, and we just have to respect each other.
For sure. For sure. Our Books to Read segment this week is brought to you by a bunch of books. It's the Eli Marks Mystery Series. This week's book is Memoirs of an Elusive Moth, Disappearing Nightly with Harry Blackstone and His Show of 1001 Wonders, written by Adele Frayel Rhindress. Most people in magic at this point, I think, know Adele. She's always everywhere. She's amazing. I first met Adele when I was maybe 17 or 18 years old, and it's sad that I don't know exactly when it is because she does, and if you ask her when she met any person, she can literally tell you the time, day, geographical location, what you were wearing. It's amazing. She's fantastic. So Adele Frayel Rhindress actually was Harry Blackstone Sr.'s assistant for a few years, and she played the elusive moth, hence the title of the book. And her memoirs here talk about her time assisting Harry Blackstone and being in such a large production show and all the rehearsals and what that was like. And that was really her dip into the magic community, where Adele still is very much like a coveted treasure. And I would really recommend this book. I am really into the Blackstone style magic shows, both senior and junior. And the fact that Adele wrote this book to discuss her time in the show is really, really cool. I really recommend checking it out. We will, of course, link to it in the showy notes. That's right, I said showy. Showy notes. Memoirs of an Elusive Moth by Adele Frayel Rhindress. Go get it now, please. This segment was sponsored by the Eli Marks Mystery Series, which has been called, quote, an instant classic in a league with Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, and Arthur Conan Doyle, end quote. The Magic Word podcast had this to say about the series, quote, if David Copperfield and Sherlock Holmes had a child, it would be Eli Marks, end quote. Wow, that's very romantic. You can pick up the first book in the series, The Ambitious Card, for just 99 cents. Grab your copy at elimarksmysteries.com. That's E-L-I-M-A-R-K-S mysteries.com. Link in the show notes. And just as a side note, I have just started reading the series, and it's actually really, really cool. I really recommend it. I'm only about halfway through The Ambitious Card, but it's a really fun ride, and it's a nice little break from 2020. Yeah. So go get it.
Hi friends, Richard Young here from the Magicians Podcast. I'm just stopping by to let you know about a brand new amazing project I've been working on, which I'm finally able to share with you. It's not a podcast. It's actually an amazing magic gimmick that creates the most incredible visual change of a playing card ever conceived. And there are dozens of applications for this new gimmick, as the face of the card can change up to, believe it or not, 4 times. We have face changes, back colour changes, cards that go blank in midair, and loads of others too. We can even make customised cards that you dream up, as the possibilities are endless. There are some fascinating untapped uses for mentalism too. Visit the website right now to see the trailer, changingcards.com. That's changingcards.com.
The Historical Women segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic Podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. I want to tell you about a woman that I have seen everywhere forever. Her amazing, elaborate, beautiful, colorful posters have been in every magic place ever. I own a poster. I've just seen them in friends' houses, but I actually never knew who she was, so figured she would be a fantastic woman to do a little bit of research on. And that is Ionia, right? I said the name and you went, I do know what poster that is. So Ionia was born Clementine de Vere in Belgium and often went by the Enchantress or the Goddess of Mystery. Her parents were both magicians. Her father, Charles de Vere, was an illusionist and magic shop owner. And her mother, Julia, performed as Okita, which may have been one of, if not the first, Asian culture-appropriated magic act. At 15 years old, Clementine married Herman Armand Wertheim, which I hope very much I said correctly, who was a circus performer from America. They traveled together for his career. In 1911, Clementine performed for the first time as Ionia. Her show was this massive production show with elaborate costumes and props and lots of assistants, both male and female. And she made the cover of The Sphinx, which was a magic magazine of the time, in the same year. Although the show only lasted about 3 years, the beautiful posters can still be seen everywhere, mainly reprints, of course. But the originals, although they are mostly gone, a few of them remain and are hot ticket items for collectors. And in fact, there was a couple of pieces of paper found with what seems like Ionia's personal memoirs, and those were sold as a collector's item a few years back. So I wish I knew who had them, because I'd love to check them out. If anyone knows who has them, it sounds like a really cool thing to check out. And that is Ionia. The Magical Women segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic Podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. Every week, if you listen to the Penguin Magic Podcast, you get a 25% discount code on the feature download of the week. You can hear stories from your favorite magicians, behind the scenes at Penguin, and save money on some of the best new magic. Visit podcast.penguinmagic.com for that great, great discount code. And, you know, lots of other stuff. Yeah. The Tools of the Trade segment is brought to you by The Magic Apple, the store on the second floor in Studio City. I'm going to talk to you today about the deluxe close-up pad that the Magic Apple is selling. I got one of these recently when stuff started going virtual. I'll be honest, I've never owned a close-up pad before, which is funny because I do so much close-up work, but I always just found it really difficult to use a close-up pad in real-life situations unless you were sitting down for a formal close-up show. I can't bring a close-up pad, and you shouldn't bring a close-up pad to do restaurant work or bar magic, because obviously in bar magic, you need stuff to be visible from further away. So I never got one before, and now I have this deluxe close-up pad in this beautiful red velvet color. It's fantastic. I'm using it in all of my shows now virtually. It's soft, it works, it's big enough to do what I need to do and still look good. It just looks professional. It's not a flimsy close-up mat, and it's really lightweight and easy to move around. It's not foldable, but actually I prefer that because it looks a little bit more like I cared. So I really recommend getting a deluxe close-up pad, and you can get it at The Magic Apple, who is the sponsor of our Tools of the Trade segment. The Magic Apple, the store on the second floor in Studio City. Visit themagicapple.com and use the coupon code Shazam to get 20% off your entire order, including the deluxe close-up pad. As is Shazam tradition, we end every interview episode with the lightning round. Cotty hates this. It's great. Once you see the questions, you'll be like, oh, okay, great. So here's how the lightning round works. I'm going to ask you a series of fun, some are informative, but some are fun questions. You can answer them as short as you want, or do it as Max Maven and answer 2 hours per question. I'm so happy you laugh. Every episode I say this joke for like 2 years, and I just needed you to laugh. So I'm glad. Are you
the others not laugh?
No. They do, unless they don't know who Max is. Oh. And then they're like, I'm confused. And then I'm almost certain Max is going to send me an email one day and go, just drop it, which is great. So, and I really look forward to that email because
I love Max Maven.
Isn't he wonderful?
Now there is a legend in show business.
Right. Yep. Just
if
watch
I could
Max
just have that voice, just like the woman version of that voice. So I had yeah. that modulated voice.
I want the hair.
Widow's peak.
Please.
Create a widow's peak.
Oh, easily. I have a tiny little one that yeah. is genetic, but yeah, I'll just boom, boom right there, right down to the eyebrows. Boom. This is such a side thing, and nobody take this idea. So for Halloween one year, I want to go to the castle as the Max Maven antithesis. So I want to go as Mickey Maven, and it's just like bright rainbow sparkle everything, but no, still the widow's peak.
Yeah, it has to be neon. Everything should be neon.
Yeah, like annoying, like annoyingly yeah. in your face. And I maybe I'll do that the next time there's a Halloween that we can go out. All right, you ready?
Yep.
Okay, lightning round. Outside of anything to do with magic, what has been your favorite activity to do during a pandemic?
Eating.
Oh, very nice. Go to resource to stay up to date with fun magic.
Internet.
The internet. Great, great, great. Any particular place on the internet?
Oh, a smorgasbord, because you can find books, you can find YouTube. Okay, sorry, quick
yeah,
round.
No, you're allowed to answer as long as you want.
The internet is fabulous because books, the Tarbo books are on the internet. You can find anything on the internet. So if you are patient and you weed through it. So my go-to at this point in time is internet. Imaging, branding, quotes, you name it, internet.
Yeah. I love it. What's your biggest pet peeve that magicians do?
Arrogance. Yeah.
Yes.
Arrogance and not being kind to each other. And that goes back to treat people like you'd like to be treated.
Yep. Great. Angela Sanchez asks, where is magic going next? That's a quick answer, isn't it?
Well, my crystal ball is a bit foggy at the moment. Truly, I believe when this pandemic ends and we will have social gathering again, there's going to be a great need for comedy relief. And magic brings a sense of wonder and awe and suspending belief. And I think people need that. I think they need to believe in the impossible, and I think they need to laugh. So I truly believe that there will be a place for magic. Now, whether that is going to be close-up magic, where it's going to be giant grand illusions, that I don't know because my crystal ball is foggy.
I love it. Big dogs or little dogs? You can also answer cats.
I am answering cats, absolutely.
I felt that on your face.
Dogs, so no. My family are dog people, but I'm a cat person. Always have been, always will be.
I love it. If you could only eat one dessert for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Ooh, I'm not a dessert person. I'm a salty, a savory person. But if I had to have one dessert, it would be raspberry shortcake. That is a nice dessert.
Oh, that sounds good. What's your favorite costume you've ever worn?
I'm going to be really
on stage, bright. On stage. Just making that clear.
Yeah. I think my favorite costume is my most controversial costume, and that would be my man suit.
Oh.
And Deanna Shimada came up with this idea. I was getting bored with doing doves, straight doves, like Shimada taught me. But after a while, it's really important as an illusionist to establish you have skills. Otherwise, the general public think that the props are doing the magic, not you, unless you're doing physical magic. But in general, they see a box, they think this box is self-working, which we know it is not, but we can't explain it to them because that would expose the magic. So I had been doing doves for years, and I tried all kinds of different things and, you know, to challenge myself. Again, 12 shows a week, year after year. So you kind of get good at it and it gets a little bit old. And so Deanna said to me, why don't you do a Victor Victoria piece? And I went, brilliant. Younger generation, Victor Victoria was a movie with Julie Andrews. And she played a man. So she was disguised as a man and she played a man. So that was Victor and Victoria. And so she said, why don't you do a magic routine like that? And I just loved the idea. So I started working on it. Well, it ended up being a over 2-year process. And it's one of those routines that I developed on the ship because I could never have developed it in Las Vegas because it was really hard in the beginning and rough. And the challenges were, it was my opening act. So my last name is Boyd. So we introduced me as the magic of Boyd, and Boyd is a boy's name. So it worked beautifully. And we did all the marquees. I stopped using Connie Boyd. I was just the magic of Boyd. And I started as a male magician. And I did full on dove work. And at a certain point in this male magician routine, I became a woman, but then I had to stay in that look for the whole show. So I had to be an attractive woman at the end of this, but I had to be a believable man, which is very tricky because if you're doing proper makeup to be a man, you would shade your jawline and it would be more grays and blues. Because if you look at men for the beard, for the growth, it's darker. So there was a series of challenges to overcome. So I had a wig and I had fake eyebrows and I had glasses and I had a goatee and I had a little man suit that was completely, I had to rework and relearn all of my dove work because it was different steels, different poles because they were in different positions. It was just completely compressed in the front. Men's shoes, I had to adjust how I walked because men walk differently. Now, what I had in my favor is many male magicians are a bit effeminate in that they're a little graceful. So I tried to be anti-graceful, but still I was, you know, you are a woman, so it's very difficult. But it was believable enough that when I walked on stage and I did my routine, nobody ever thought I was a woman. They all believed I was a man. And I worked very fast. So I did the dubs quick So the doves were fast. So they're responding to the birds appearing. They're responding to the magic. And it worked. And so I produced, I think, 5 or 6 doves. And then later on, I even had an assistant. I had 2 assistants in long lace, red lace gowns that they had on a basque and a G-string underneath it. So they were fabulous misdirection. So every time they came out for a dove, all the men looked at the girl. And so that was even better. The act got stronger and stronger as my little man routine got better. So that man's suit, it was a very tricky suit. Like once I was in it, I couldn't bend down. I couldn't move because it had to tear away at the end, but it had to be solid enough that I could do dove work. So I would do the dove routine and then I would rip off my suit and I'd be in my obvious girl outfit and take off my eyebrows and my goatee and my wig. And now I'm a girl. And then I would take all of those and all the silks were placed. It was a little baby blammo box. And I put the last accessories in the baby blammo box and whip off the top. And my high heel shoes were there. So then I put my shoes on and then I had a Norm Nielsen dove vanish and I would vanish the doves. And that was my opening. And it was killer. And then the tagline was, behind every successful man, there's a woman. And I learned that in multiple languages because it was funny. And it was a great opener. But that costume, it was my nemesis. It took a long time. Joni worked with me. We worked and worked on that routine. And I did that routine on The World's Greatest Magic when I got the Best Cabaret Award. So I did that. Cool. And I did the guitar suspension. Both routines, the guitar suspension we originally did in Vegas with a boy. But then, you know, things change and I didn't have the assistance I had when I had my own crew working with me. So I started doing the guitar levitation myself, but I worked it out. So it was the guitar in a hoop and the hoop I would pick up with the heel of my shoe. And so it was a self-contained and it did 360 spins and it was quite a strong illusion. And it turned into being a solo illusion. Again, you had to be very physically fit to be able to do it. And so both of those routines were unique to me. And those are the two routines that they selected when I won the Best Cabaret Magician at the World's Greatest Magic. So I got a lot of pushback from the boys over that one because they thought I was trying to prove I was better than a man. And it had nothing to do with that. It was that the illusion of the stereotypical magician. And I was exactly the stereotypical magician with big black hair and the whole 9 yards. And when I became a woman, it really rocked the house. It was really strong. Big effort, but worth it.
This is just a really funny thing to add on. When I was 9 years old, my mentor went, I have a great idea. And, and threw me into a magic competition. It was not good. But I basically, because he had also mentored Tony Clark, and Tony Clark did a Phantom of the Opera act. Yes. And so I would start as the Phantom of the Opera and do D-lights, turn around, take everything off, and then boom, I'm a girl. The problem to all of that is that my name is Kayla, and that's pretty, like, you could take a guess that's not a guy. So when I came out as this really sort of gender neutral kind of child, and then all of a sudden it's a girl, it did not get the reaction. I mean, the whole act is terrible, but I just find it funny. And I now wonder if he saw you perform this, because this would have been in like 1999, 2000.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So I feel like he went and saw you perform and came back and was like, I have a great idea.
I know what I'll do with that girl. I'll dress her like a boy.
I nailed it. Also, he was so great. And chances are that he's like, she's 9. It's fine. But I just think that's so funny. And now that you're saying that, I'm like, oh, I wonder if there's a backstory.
Do you know a better story? This happened a couple years ago. And you never know, like, I've been off the planet for a while in Connie Land working on my own productions and just, you know,
it sounds like a nice place.
I live in a bubble. It's beautiful. It was until the pandemic hit, but I live in a beautiful land. And 2 years ago, I went back to Vegas and I wanted to see Matt Franco because I'd missed the whole AGT thing and I had heard nice things about him and I wanted to go see him. So I have a friend in Vegas and we went to see the show. So apparently he knew I was coming. I didn't know he knew. So he did the whole show and I loved him. I love his sincerity. I love his presentation. There's so many sincere moments in his show that just you can learn so much from. Every performer should watch him because he's got likability factor. I can't say enough. I really, really enjoyed it. And so afterwards, my friend wanted to do the meet and greet. And I'm a bit shy. I don't like to impose on people. So we went to do the meet and greet. And we shook his hand. And I said, hi, I'm Connie Boyd. And he went, Connie Boyd? And he said, I watched you. I was a kid. And I watched you on the World Magic Awards. And your dubs were fantastic. And I was doing dubs at the time. And I'm thinking, oh my God, he was learning from the man dub routine. And he said, and then you were a girl. And he said, I'll never forget it. He said, we were fooled. And it was just such a, I think that was one of the most precious moments I've had in quite a few years, because it's like, hey, maybe I made a difference. Mm. And you never think you do, you know?
That's so cool. Okay. Last lightning round question.
Yeah, that was not a good lightning. It's so fine. Long-winded. Sorry.
I'm really not about rules. Can you just give a shout out to a woman in magic that we should all check out? Everyone should Google her right away.
Oh, because she's so great. Many. Oh, that's not fair. I can't.
Do maybe one that's like that, you know, we all know Juliana or Luna or Carissa. Like we all know, you know, so maybe someone that we don't all know that we should definitely take a look at.
Two in California, I have to give you two, and they're in the same age range. And it would be Tina Leonard and Diana Zimmerman.
Ah,
because,
sure.
Yeah, both of them are just legends. They're living legends, and they've done magic proud, and they have dignity, and they've been huge successes in very different ways. And I am very grateful to them because both of them set a platform. When I started magic, I didn't know them. You know, it took me probably working in Vegas 6 years before somebody even mentioned them. You know, I think I saw Tina Leonard first, maybe in the castle. Yeah, maybe I knew Tina within the first 3 years, but Diana, it was Bill Smith that I think mentioned her, and I didn't know who she was. You know, shame on me, but I didn't. And now I know a lot more about the history of magic, and I know what she's done and continues to do for magic as an art form, and shame on me. And then I want to give a heads up to Amanda Nepo, that's like now 15 years old and is a new creator. And so we're in the whole gamut, but every one of my magical women I love, and I kind of take everybody in. You know, it's my family. Magic is my family, and I care about the magicians deeply, and I care about magic deeply. And so, yeah, I don't really have a favorite. I have lots of favorites.
Those are great. No, yeah, more just like, hey, if you haven't heard of her, you should definitely check her out. Well, I think that's perfect.
Yeah, I think a lot of people didn't know about Diana, and she was one of the reasons. Yeah, that she's one of the reasons, I want to do this because they need to know about Gay Blackstone and what she's achieved for women in magic and magicians in general. I don't think there's been another magician that's done more for magicians, provided more work, more opportunities, more, you know?
Yeah.
It's a lot.
So. Yeah.
Credit where it's due, and they had to earn it. It didn't come easy.
Right. Can you tell everyone where can they find you and also Magical Women? We will link to all of these in our show notes. So where can people do all that?
Magical Women is YouTube channel, Magical Women. And we also have a Facebook page. And this week we're starting Instagram. So woohoo! We're doing it slowly because it's just too much to take it all on at once. And then Connie Boyd Magic is my website. And if you go to talent, you can see all the magicians that I work with there. And if you go to the shows, you can see there's promo for The Beauty of Magic, Chicks with Tricks, Illusionista, and Illusions. Those are the four shows I have. So,
That's great. Connie, thank you so much. This is so great.
I had so much fun. I hope I haven't rambled too much.
It's perfect. I love it. Thanks, Connie.
Thank you.
And that's the episode. Don't forget to follow us on the socials at SheZamPod. For all things swag, head over to our website at SheZamPod.com for shirts, pins, and that coveted Don't Touch Me skateboard. You know you need it. If you are interested in the bonus content for this episode and future episodes, plus exclusive swag designs, behind-the-scenes content, and shout-outs in episodes, become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/SheZamPod. Links to everything are in our show notes. You can also sponsor one of our many segments this season. I still have some spots left, so please email me at shezampod@gmail.com if you'd like to find out more. Shazam is sponsored in part by the International Brotherhood of Magicians and the Society of American Magicians. Thank you to the IBM and the SAM for your support. Our audio producer is Chris Combs. The Shazam theme song is recorded and produced by Kevin Karikas with vocals by Jonah Fagel. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you soon. Bye.